for the week of August 23rd, 2020. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 507, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in the Calamari comeback state of Rhode Island, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why are we talking about calamari? Are you hungry or something?
Surely you know the reference.
Calamari comeback state.
You did not watch the convention, clearly.
I did. I watched parts of it. I didn't really watch anything.
The Democratic Convention, one of their big successes was the roll call of states, which is normally the most boring part of a convention. But because this was a virtual convention, instead of some people in a room with a big hat on going, the great state of Oklahoma gives its 10 electoral votes to Joe Biden. Instead of that, they had people all over the country. They had people in great locations, stunning vistas, important landmarks. They had families, young people, old people, celebrities, politicians, and Rhode Island stole the show by the man's announcing it. And behind him is a chef with a giant plate of fried calamari. It was hilarious. It was so goofy, but it was fun, you know, and apparently it's like the state food or one of their state foods or something like that. But nobody will know what we're talking about within a week. So, you know, it's a joke with a very short half-life.
Yeah, and I tuned in halfway through it, so I didn't even see the, you know.
I didn't watch it, but everybody talked about it afterwards. I didn't watch that section, but I did see a little bit of it, but everybody talked about that afterwards.
Well, and what, you know, speaking of things that, you know, I didn't see or don't do, or you know I'm not a popular TikTok star. You know how you know that?
How?
Because my power is still on, okay? I still have electricity. See Bryce Hall, or as I like to call him, who?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, here in Los Angeles, there are all these like TikTok houses, these
celebrity influencer houses.
Yeah, and so I guess they're having parties, and Mayor Eric Garcetti is running around having their power shut off.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah, that's not a great way to enforce social guidelines, sending the cops in. But it's like, you know, there are better ways to do it. You know, we don't want police run. You got to run a party. It's not the best idea.
Okay, well.
But it's a business, so I guess that's different. It is a business, arguably, yeah. You know, though everybody works from their home, so you could say that about anyone. But I'm not a big fan of sending cops because you're having a party. I'm also not a fan of the party. Don't get me wrong.
These houses, they're all over the place now. It seems like they're, and they're all filled with like 18-year-olds who are making more money than God.
Well, and God's pretty profitable.
Yeah, that's true. Although I haven't, you know, I don't think God's been audited lately.
So in California, they're talking about the TikTok parties. What are we going to talk about on our show this week?
Well, apparently TikTok parties. But this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are actually very excited because a movie is playing in theaters and making a lot of money.
Woohoo!
Yeah, well, assuming that's not followed by a spike in coronavirus cases, you know, fair China enough. May be showing the world how movie going can get back to normal. I'm also very interested in the new management / production company launched by former CAA agent Peter Michelli, also one of my former coworkers, and it's being joined by a lot of major players in the business.
So instead of making headlines, you are reading a headline about people you worked with. Success.
Correct. Yes. Yeah, well, thanks for pointing that out.
I don't even have coworkers, so don't feel bad. I'm a freelancer.
On Inside Baseball, we look closely at the terms Warner Brothers is asking for when they release the new Christopher Nolan film, Tenet. If you're a theater owner, you may want to manipulate time and go back to the simpler days when a studio got 50% of the box office and was happy. Quick, someone call John David Washington and get on that. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss some of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office. And yes, box office, not VOD, not video on demand, not premium video on demand, box office, because we have a big fat smash hit on our hands. It's made, hold on, $150,000. Probably.
No more than that. No, we have a big hit.
I'm kidding.
So we were going to cover, I was planning not to cover video on demand this week in North America because hearing the numbers that they were actually bringing in, it seemed so negligible, it didn't seem worth shining a spotlight on it. If you're not going to tell us the money being grossed and you're only going to give us a chart with the favorites, this may be one reason. But we know there's a lot of money being generated in various ways in the home video space. But you know, $1 million for the top film on the video on demand chart, I thought, why are we covering this? If we get a glimpse in and find out that's how little you're making, that's not a very important area of concern. But beyond that, ComScore didn't have a chart up yet this week, so we couldn't have talked about it anyway. So we are going to talk about the worldwide box office, and the number one movie around the world is The 800. It made $120 million worldwide. Every day, Saturday, then Sunday morning, then Sunday night, then Monday, they keep updating how much money it made. So you know it wasn't just front-loaded over the weekend. Well, it was on all week in China. It started on Monday. But not only was it not front-loaded, but the word of mouth and the reviews are great because it did not drop a beat come Saturday or Sunday playdates. So this movie has done very, very well. It was shot all in IMAX. And it's the World War II film about when China fought a battle to defend Shanghai from Japan. They were invading the country. And this battle gave troops time to get away and fight another day. It takes place in 1937, by the way. But I'm calling it a World War II film because many historians now say, yeah, you know, Japan's invasion of China is really a much better starting date than 1939 with Hitler invading Poland. The others even dated earlier than that, but this is a World War II film. And of course, it's a controversial film, as you know. It was delayed in China because somebody in the government got angry that the movie was focusing on an event that Chiang Kai-shek's soldiers were basically involved in. It was the bad guys, as far as the Communist Party is concerned. But they were the heroes who were involved at that stage, fighting off the Japanese, and they didn't like it. So now the film has been released, and it's 13 minutes shorter. I guess they cut out all the references to Chiang Kai-shek.
Yeah, well, what is it? What is there? The two systems, one country kind of thing, right? Like mm-hmm. Taiwan, and which is where Chiang Kai-shek, you know, and his team
fled to,
yeah.
Or retreated, if you prefer, yeah.
And then there's the mainland China. So it's, you know, one country, unless you're making a movie, in which case it darn well better be one country, one system.
Well, that's really Hong Kong. It's nothing to do with Taiwan. So this is a lot of money. $120 million were left, you know, were grossed basically in China. They made a lot of money on IMAX. But here's the thing. No screens were left for any other films in China. They had 60% of all screenings, which I assume means showtimes as opposed to physical screens, but I'm not sure about that. And so the second closest movie was Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, which has been doing really well in China. That was only on 11% of all screenings, meaning 60% were The 800. And then way down at, you know, second place was Harry Potter with only 11% of the screenings. That tells me you can release a big movie in North America as long as you run all the screens, even with 50% capacity, you can make good money. But guess what? There's not room for a second film. You know, week two, if you want to keep making big money, you're going to still need all those screens. There's not room for Wonder Woman in week two, but we'll get to that in Inside Baseball. So the number one movie, yeah. I'm sorry, what do you want to say?
I was going to mention the fact that this is the way box office works and why we report on it. Mm-hmm. Certainly I knew about The 800, had no interest in seeing it at all. But now I do. I want to see this film. Come on, bring it on over.
Well, I want to see the director's cut. I want to see the one with the 13 minutes. But anyway, so it gobbled up the box office. People went, not every city was even open. And they had, I believe, 50% capacity around the country in most places. But that's what it did. And it made good money. We don't know the budget, really, I don't think. I should have checked that up again. But the number two film around the world is a format. We're going to give a shout out to IMAX. Most of that money was made for The 800, which was shot entirely on IMAX. So that's a film I'd like to see in the director's cut on IMAX, because that's worthwhile. Just like I would probably want to see Tenet, depending how much of that film was shot on IMAX. But in the IMAX format worldwide, all movies combined, they grossed $7.5 million. That's the second biggest gross number we have, and it's for a format, not a film.
And number three, that said, IMAX will be the guest on this week's CJ Cinema Summit on Thursday. You can register for that, cjcinemasummit.com.
Oh, that's cool. That's on Thursday at what time?
At 9 a.m. Pacific and 5 p.m. London time.
Well, that's interesting. And are there any particular things on the topic, on the menu to discuss?
Tenet and, of course, China and how they're doing in China. And, you know, but definitely Tenet and mm-hmm. how they, you know, are marketing and dealing with Tenet.
Not to put you on the spot, how much of Tenet was shot on IMAX, do you know?
quite a bit. I think it was, I don't know. I think it was, I don't know. I will find out as
more
as
than a little.
More than a little, yeah. Less than a bread box, more than, yeah.
The does it cost, how much does it cost to register for that?
Let's see, if you carry the one, carry the zero. Two. Yeah, it's free, it's free.
Yeah, you're not very good at making money, are you?
No, we are horrible at making money.
This sounds like a great event. I may check in. At number one around the world is the 800, $120 million. At number two, a format, IMAX, which made $7.5 million. They might like the fact that we just shouted out to them just for the format alone. At number three is Unhinged, the Russell Crowe flick. That made $4 million, and it's at $13 million worldwide. It had a $33 million budget overall. And here's something that's interesting. It's playing in North America. Theaters are opening up. But for this movie, the biggest player in North America, the most popular locations are drive-ins. So even though I have a local theater that opened up, an AMC in Vestavia Hills in Birmingham, Alabama, that has opened up, but the most popular locations around the country are still drive-ins, and I can understand why. I might drive an hour away if I can go see Tenet on a drive-in screen. I'm not ready yet to go back to AMC, but I checked the show times all week. They opened up on Thursday. They had a 15-cent ticket promo on opening day, and they were showing things like Goonies and Back to the Future and new movies and Star Wars Empire Strikes Back, but they were only charging 15 cents. They were all sold out. Even, you know, they only had like two screens a day, like 4 and 7 for Goonies or 6 and 9 for Inception, right? I kept looking on the weekend. Once they went to full price, a lot of these movies were selling out. Now, of course, it's half capacity, but still. And, you know, some of the Vestavia Hills Theater is a sort of a Barca Lounger theater. They don't have screens with a ton of seats, and they do kind of sell out kind of quickly, but people are kind of ready. And, you know, they are going in when they're available. We'll have to see if those people are the tip of the iceberg or whether other people will follow them. But it is happening. People are going back to the movies at least a little bit. So the 800 followed by IMAX, followed by Unhinged at $4 million. And then Deliver Us From Evil, the Korean thriller, that made another $4 million. That's at $30 million worldwide. Then there's another new film on the charts. This is a Korean film as well. It's Okay, Madam. It's a Korean comedy, and it made $4 million, and it's at $9 million worldwide. So we missed it last week. We, you know, this is how hard it is to track down what's making money. There's not a big central place like Comscore stepping up to the plate for every territory. So we're sort of figuring out info as we can. Right below that is Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone in 3D. That also made about $4 million. This release, it's grossed $24 million, basically in China. And of course, it has passed the $1 billion mark worldwide. Then there's Pixar's Onward at $2 million. Tenet, that opened up commercially. It's in Korea with some sneak performances. It made $750,000 in some sneak previews. I'm not sure what the per screen average was. I'm sure it was probably sold out at a lot of the sneaks. That's the good news. The bad news is Korea has seen a spike in coronavirus cases, not specifically linked to movie theaters, but they are seeing a spike, and those theaters may be shutting back down. Right below that is SpongeBob, Sponge on the Run. That made about $500,000, mostly in Canada. And then right below that, Words on Bathroom Walls, a teen flick that made $460,000. Gee, I wonder, was that movie any good?
Actually, you know what? I can tell you this much. It is teenage daughter approved. I actually happened to see the film over the weekend. You know, it's actually playing, I think, in virtual cinemas. I can't remember. No, maybe, actually, this was real cinemas. Coronation, Ai Weiwei's film. This is the film that he directed from afar. He was in, I think it was Britain or Portugal, and it was directed remotely. It takes place in Wuhan, China during the lockdown, and he had all these people running around with cameras, and he got 500 hours of footage, and he made a movie out of it.
Very cool.
You can watch on Alamo Drafthouse Virtual Cinema, but Words on Bathroom Walls.
Right, tons of movies are available video on demand or at screenings and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, this one is...
in movie theaters.
It's in movie theaters. It's about a schizophrenic teenager going through his senior year who is diagnosed with schizophrenia and how he kind of overcomes that. It is definitely geared towards teenagers. It's definitely, a heartwarming movie. It's a, you know, for what it is, it really works.
Right. He doesn't overcome schizophrenia so much as learn to live with that chronic condition, but that's great. But so you took your daughter to the movies.
I took her to the couch where we actually watched it in the home screening room.
So this movie is playing in theaters as well as home, but you did not go to a physical theater.
No, I happened to get a screener because that is the way journalists are now reviewing films.
You got a screener. They get links. You got a link or you got a physical copy?
A link.
Okay, yeah. Oh, okay. So all has been cleared up. You didn't go to the movie theaters. No. I was going to want to hear what that was like. So, all right. Your daughter gave it a big thumbs up.
Both daughters, big thumbs up. They really liked it.
Oh, okay. It was just age appropriate for both of them.
Yes. And Andy Garcia, boy, he's in this film. And he's just, you know, he plays a priest. And just from the moment he comes on screen.
You're like, no.
He's just so good. He's such a good actor.
Oh, yeah. You bought him as a priest. Okay, yeah. Nice to hear.
And he's so understated, and it works.
Yeah, he is a good actor. So that's the box office. ComScore is providing some information now, though the chart is not back up. I have not seen a Korean chart. I have not seen India. When I go to the Indian box office charts that I have access to, I am not seeing a chart for that country as well. I assume some movies are being shown there. I assume they're making money, but I have no information about that. If you've got charts and information for your territories, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. Now, I have been trying desperately to find out how much of Tenet was shot in IMAX. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that nobody wants to tell us. Nobody actually wants to. IMAX doesn't want to tell us.
Normally, they like to promote that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard everything between 40% to 60%. So who knows?
Okay, so about half.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Well, you know what's also interesting is the big shakeup in the Hollywood agency business. This is a story that could only warm the hearts of beleaguered agents everywhere. Everybody else is like, what? Whatever. Okay. But it's big news if you're in Hollywood. Big news if your agent is involved. There's been a big shakeup. Probably the biggest since Endeavor was launched. How many years ago?
1995, I believe. 1994, 95?
This is probably close to that in its importance. So one-time CAA player Pete Michelli left that company, and he's now launching a blockbuster new company, but it's not an agency. It combines personal management with a production company. Do we have a name yet?
I don't think so.
He's attracted. Somebody's paying trademark people and people with the ways of coming up with nifty names a lot of money right now. Well, he's attracted the deep pockets of investors like Steve Cohen, and he has a range of talent from across the talent agency landscape. William Morris Endeavor's Rich Cook, four people from UTA, including Russo's, Fox, McKinney's, Moorhead, four people from CAA, Wiggum, Sullivan, Bugliari, Cooper. Good heavens, a lot of people from all the big agencies have stopped being agents and are now going to become personal managers and be involved in a production company. So what's the deal? We know this has been in the works for a while, but is there possible that some of these people have jumped because of the pandemic and the WGA victory? Is it just agents are being furloughed, agents are being fired? Do they just say, you know what, why not roll the dice on myself because I don't know how much my company has my back? Is that what's going on here?
To answer all of your questions, yes. So just one quick correction. Pete Michelli, who, again, full disclosure, I worked with, haven't spoken with him in years. He was the head of
television.
The television department over at CAA, but then left and was the head of E1, one of their strategy people. So wasn't the head, but he was.
That's right, but we still think of him. His biggest claim to fame before this was probably CAA, right?
Right.
He wasn't making a lot of waves at E1.
No, he started at CAA in 1995 as a trainee, and he worked his way up.
So not knowing anything about the biz, here was my one question. Is this sort of an indication that agents are being shackled too much, that they don't have the same freedom they had before when they could do package deals and stuff? Are agents passe? Is being a manager the hot new thing? Because these are all people who had that decision. Do I want to be a manager or do I want to be an agent? And they all chose agent, and they were all very successful. And now they are switching courses and say, we want to be managers, but is being an agent a little passé?
I'm going to answer that in two waves. Take coronavirus out, and the answer would be yes, that would be your immediate answer. That would be, hey, you know, these people are either not making enough money at any one of these agencies. They feel like they can get in on the ground floor, much the way Patrick Weitzel and Ari Emanuel did over at Endeavor. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, they're running William Morris Endeavor. So this might be a way for them to kind of expedite their career, so to speak. However, so that's the first way. With this, with coronavirus, it could be that they were furloughed. It could be that they were making, a quarter of what they were making. It could be that they were next on the chopping block. It could be that they were actually let go. It could, although actually, no. given the fact that they're leaving,
yeah.
It seems that they were still at their respective agencies. Does it have anything to do with the WGA?
Here's the reason why I asked that, because a lot of writers fired their agent and they don't all necessarily think they need their agent back. Obviously, new people do need that help, but established players are like, hey, you know what? That 10%, I can keep that for myself. You might say that's foolish as an agent, but that may be happening. People may be rethinking their relationships with their agents and their managers and all the other people on their team. So maybe they said, we want to be in the management area, because people aren't getting rid of their managers, but they may be thinking twice about having an agent.
Well, and all of these agencies, William Morris Endeavor, UTA, CAA, they are all big corporations now. They used mm-hmm. to be just, you know, partnerships.
Boutiques yeah. almost.
Yeah. They're incredibly powerful. CAA, you know, they represent, think of an A-list star. And one of these agencies that I just mentioned probably represents them.
Right.
And by the way, the same is true of writers and directors and showrunners. So that's why you wanted to be at agencies. That was where everything happened. That was where, you know, you were at the center of everything.
But now they're so big, you're just a cog in the machine.
Yes, correct. And they have, you know, shareholders to answer to. They have loans to pay off. They have other businesses to run, you know, live event businesses to run. They have now affiliated production companies to run. So if you're going to have an affiliated production company anyway, you may as well be a manager where you actually get producer credit and producer fees for that work.
Yeah, how important is the management, the production company? Is it just that if you're going to launch something like this, there's no way you wouldn't have a production company? You're just like, well, we got to have a production company, just like you got to have, you know, a cloud-based service so you can work from anywhere and, have it set it up so people can work from home, because who knows if we'll ever have offices again. Or is that production company really a key part of what they're doing here? We don't really know yet. They don't even have a name, but what's your guess?
You know, it's funny. I was, watching, well, my kids actually were watching Parks and Rec.
Mm-hmm. The new special?
They were just watching, you know, Netflix. Old.
Okay.
And at the end of one, they had they put all the production companies up, and one of the production companies was Brillstein Gray Entertainment, or Brillstein Gray Partners, a management firm that was run by Brad Gray and Bernie Brillstein, and they make a fortune on these types of
shows. Yes. Yeah.
So yeah, you can make a lot of money as a production company. Now they also probably managed some of the showrunners and or the talent. So I know for a while, I don't want to say that. I was going to say they represented Brad Pitt, but a lot of people were represented by Brillstein Gray. I don't know necessarily whether that's true anymore. Gary Shandling was represented by Brillstein
Definitely.
Gray.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. But of course, the Bernie Brillstein, I think he passed away, as did Brad Gray. So, you know, I think, but to answer your question, yes, you can make a lot of money.
Right. But this isn't just something they're doing like, well, you got to have a production company, or is this really like, maybe that's even the bigger play for them? We want to be managed and have a production company, because with a production company, we can do this. You know, maybe that's where their heart and soul and energy will be going. Or is it just something, well, you wouldn't launch a company like a management company without having an adjacent production company?
It's more the latter.
Okay.
You know, if you're going to be a manager rather than an agent, then you may as well have a production company, because that's where a lot of your money will come from.
Well, I have to admit, I didn't think it was a big deal, even though as more and more people left different agencies to join it, you could see, all right, well, there's a lot of big names, you know, a lot of talent from all the three big, you know, agencies. So obviously it loomed larger as we got closer to air dates. So I can understand why you correctly said, hey, no, we got to do a story on this.
Well, given all of the movement and all of the news coming out of agencies, whether it's through the WGA or through furloughs or through, you know, salary reductions, or through loans coming due, this is kind of big news.
Yeah, I imagine it's fun because they got to whoop it up when they made their big announcement.
Right, but it will be a bigger deal when all of a sudden you see talent signing with them and the first few projects get a green light and actually get released or
they start signing a lot of deals.
Right.
They'll whoop it up over that. It'll be big.
I see. We keep saying the word big, which
the
means
deal it must, and the whoop.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. You know, I never look out for the word whoop.
No,
you know,
it should have stuck out a little bit.
Yeah, I did think, wow, he's using that word whooping. Is whoop. He like, has he been, you know, yeah.
Well, I think it's because it's time for Big Deal Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Sperling, what's our first story? I mean, I handed it off to you, and where were you? Nowhere. Nowhere.
Yeah, I was like, I'm sorry.
It's like, I'm passing the basketball, and it just bounces off the court.
I'm in the bubble. I'm in the NBA bubble. So, right. Yeah. Well, now, speaking of former coworkers, after decades as a major player in Hollywood, one-time CAA bigwig, creative artist agency bigwig, and studio suit, Ron Meyer, he is out at NBC Universal. The exec is highly respected, but that won't protect you, I guess, when you break some rules. Meyer has long been known to have issues with gambling and apparently women, but recently he came to his bosses and told them he had a consensual affair with an actress, then paid her off for unspecified but untrue accusations, and then faced a shakedown from others who knew about the whole ugly mess. Many bemoan the fact that even a mensch like Meyer could be brought down by a scandal like this, which once upon a time would be seen kind of as business as usual. Oh, and the woman, by the way, that he cheated on his wife. He was married at the time. Guess who that was? It was Charlotte Kirk. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because it's the very same actress who had an extensive relationship later with Kevin Sugihara as he promoted her for various Warner Brothers projects. He was the head of Warner Brothers, the CEO of Warner Brothers. That took him down. So Charlotte Kirk has now taken down two heads of studios.
Well, he wasn't the head.
No, he was more of like a
consigliere or, you know.
Yeah. Big deal or big whoop?
First, let me ask, Sperling.
Yes?
Have you had a relationship with Charlotte Kirk?
No, I have not had a relationship with her.
I just wanted to make that clear. Let's get that out of the way.
You know what, though? Let me tell you this. If I was, if I was going to be like Charlotte Kirk, and this comes from Brooks Barnes, okay, of the New York Times, who tweeted out a message when this news broke. He said that he had contacted Charlotte Kirk and her representatives. And his representatives got back to him, a New York Times reporter, and said that she had nothing to say unless the New York Times made it financially worth her while. Literally. And I said, you know, I couldn't believe, like he just said, I can't believe this is where we're at right now.
Well, people sell their stories all the time. So I'm shocked, not the New York Times, but, you know, lots of TV shows do it. You know, TV networks, oh, we won't pay you to be on our show a la 2020. I'm not saying them in particular, but we will pay to use the photos and videos you provide.
You know? Right.
Right. Yeah. People pay people all the time. So let's not get our hair in a muffle because we're shocked by this. She should know better that the Times isn't going to do it.
Right. Exactly.
Almost everybody else does. So someday, you know, you never know. Anyway, this is a big deal. This is a changing time. She's like, oh my God, I can't believe Ron Meyer, such a great guy. He's like, yeah, but you know, he did stuff he shouldn't have. And in the old days, nobody would have cared, but now they do. It's hard, but you got to adjust.
Yeah. And I guess I look at this and I think, well, first of all, he was kind of a strategist. He was chairman emeritus or something like that.
At this stage, yes.
At this stage, yeah. And he had long said he wanted to get out of NBC Universal.
Nobody was stopping him.
Nobody was stopping him. Yeah. Although actually,
I wish I could leave.
which is why he kind of moved into that role. And when he was at CAA, he left rather than Mike Ovitz. You might recall Mike Ovitz and Ron Meyer. did a deal for Edgar Bronfman to buy Universal Studios, which included Universal Pictures. And everybody thought in 1995, okay, that's it. Or 94,
Bovis 95. Bovis is going to run another studio.
He's going to go off and run another studio. That's what's going to happen in 1995. That didn't happen. Instead, they hired Ron Meyer.
And Ovitz said, what?
Yeah, so he said, I'll show you. I'm going to go to work and become president of Walt Disney for 12 whole months. And then got paid like a fortune to leave. But that said, Ron Meyer would come back to CAA and give these master classes almost monthly. And it was great. It was fantastic. And one of the things he said is when he got to Universal, it was kind of a mess because Sidney Sheinberg and Lou Wasserman and Tom Pollock, they had all been at Universal for 25 years. And that was just way too long for anybody to be running one company. It was just...
Louis B. Mayer.
You needed fresh blood in there. And so, sure enough, he's been at Universal for 25 years now.
He's not been the head. He's not been the head.
Yes, and he hasn't been the head.
No.
And he has gone back to that statement when said he was trying to leave. He said, I don't think anybody should be running a company like this for
and he's not.
And now he's not. But he was always very well liked and still is.
Right, but there's a very suspicious thing here. He says, okay, yes, I did have a consensual relationship with this woman. But then he says, and then she accused me of something that's completely not true, but I paid her off a lot of money for it. It's like, well, wait a second. Like, you're not paying her for the cheating on your wife and to keep that quiet, but you did. She accused you of something you absolutely didn't do, and that's when you decided to give her a lot of money. That makes
which
no sense.
Which he reached $2 million.
That makes no sense. That's BS. Oh, I'm going to accuse you of something you didn't do, so... Then he pays her a lot of money. That just
what doesn't make sense to me is this was something that was done completely. I think in part, I can't remember exactly when NBC Universal. Well, when Comcast bought NBC Universal, I can't remember exactly when that was. But I don't even know if the studio was owned by Comcast back then. But it certainly happened outside of his duties. For Comcast and NBC Universal, and didn't
we
really
don't know
other
than what happened. We don't know. This is his side.
Well,
this
and
is
it's
his
also
publicly released side. We don't know what
NBC
happened.
NBC Universal side as well. They have also kind of
right. Of course, they don't want a scandal. Here. Yeah,
right.
It's their side of which they prefer to sweep it under the rug. So the idea that he would say, "Well, I slept with her, but then she accused me of something I absolutely didn't do, so I gave her, you know, seven figures." No. That doesn't
Which he
pass
didn't,
the smell
in,
test.
In the end, he didn't actually do, by the way.
All right. Well, anyway, you know, he was the head of NBC Universal for 18 years.
Yes, he was. And actually, I can't remember who it was. Maybe it was Tom Hanks. I can't remember. Maybe it was Tom Hanks when he was a young... I can't remember who it was. It was some big name star or somebody who became a big name star, but the way they signed him. This is kind of an interesting story.
This is the history of Universal and CAA and Ron Meyer, which is why we're going to have a 2-hour podcast.
No.
All we had to talk about was his stepping down. And instead, well, you know, 10 years ago and then 20. Uh-huh.
Well, that's what makes our show different from a new show.
That's right.
So
we have a sense of history.
So speaking of managers, okay. So the managers of this up-and-coming actor, actress, or whoever, came in and they said, look, you know, we would sign with UCAA, but let's face it, if we ever wanted to get Ron Meyer on the phone or Michael Obie, they're never going to take our call. Tom Hanks, Tom Cruise, sure, they'll take... And literally, in the room, they said, no, actually, Ron Meyer, that's where you're wrong. Ron Meyer will literally call anyone back. Now, he might only... And he actually said in one of these masterclasses, I will call anyone back. Now, I might say to you when I call you back, listen, you and I have no business, so thank you for the phone call, but this doesn't pertain to me, and I'm not going to call you back again, so please stop calling. Please call this other person, or please call somebody else, but I will call you back the first time. So they said to this, God, I wish I could remember who it was, because it is somebody who went on to become huge. You know what? Call him right now. Call him right now from, you know, they were at her house. Call her. He called back 5 minutes later. They were still in the meeting, and the assistant came and knocked on the door and said, Ron Meyer's on the phone for you. And they were like, they signed that particular person and went on to become a very successful actress.
That's why he was a big agent.
Yeah.
What's happening in Netflix?
Everything. But right now, actually, they are in a little bit of hot water for a trailer and a poster and other artwork promoting the new French film Cuties, which, by the way, I did see. I saw it at Sundance. And if you would have told me that I would be talking about this film right now, I would be, back then, I would have been shocked.
Well, you didn't think it was very good?
I thought it was, well, let me read this and I'll explain. The poster shows prepubescent girls posing in highly sexualized ways, in a highly sexualized manner, like kids mimicking the twerking and provocative poses they may have seen on social media. Now, after watching the trailer, one person said that parents who allowed their child to be in this film, they are pimps. The howl of protest soon had Netflix apologizing and removing the offending material. And the film Cuties, by the way, it's a French film about how society and social media pressure young girls to behave and mimic sexually provocative behavior. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I have to admit, for me, not having seen the film, it's a bit of a amusing head scratcher. I have found it creepy how teenage girl, every pop star, you got to dress in a negligee to get on Rolling Stone, or you're naked or whatever. And it's just gotten worse and worse and younger. And I'm pretty highly attuned to this stuff and think like, yeah, this is a huge problem. And this film's addressing it in a fictional story based on a real life experience the female director had. They're shining a light on this problem. And instead of going, oh, this film is trying to show how creepy and bad that is, people are like, how dare they? It's like, no. It is a film about that. But they think it's a bad thing. So maybe yes, you should see the film. It's a little ridiculous.
And there is a scene in the film where the adults are like, what are you doing?
Right.
And as a father of two teenage girls, I can tell you that, yes, it was very uncomfortable to watch this film. And
oh, yeah,
as they're going through it, I have to say the whole time I was like, oh my God, what is this movie? Like, how are you? This is ridiculous. This is absurd. Why do you keep showing this? And then the moral of the story is the moral of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know,
it's like Netflix, all the beauty pageants you've seen when you've got little girls and you're like, they're not always twerking, but you're like, this is creepy and awful. Like, you shouldn't be doing
creepy.
This. Yeah. And that's what the film is talking about.
It's as creepy as me, my neighbors.
Oh, you're creepy in general.
Well, what I was going to say is that my neighbors across the street, their kids are now, one has graduated from high school, one is on the cheerleading team and must be 17 years old. And she got out of a car recently and ran across the street from, she was running around with her friends. And I was this close to saying, that's a nice bathing suit you're almost wearing at the age of like 17. Like, hello, put some clothes on for Pete's sake.
American Beauty much? Okay. All right, keep moving. Well, yes.
That's why I didn't say it.
That's a good call. Don't comment on other people's children's attire.
Yeah.
Well. Good call.
And then I immediately went into the house and threw away all of my daughter's.
Yeah, you are not wearing these pants. Yeah,
exactly. You're not going outside. Put this on. Yeah. In any case, remember when we were talking about the Tony Awards back in June? Yeah, well, they are going to take place.
Woohoo!
Online. Yeah, this fall.
Yes.
And they're going to take place online.
Oh.
Oh, and some of the shows that opened up, like West Side Story, they will be eligible in the following season, okay, which is actually kind of odd since so few shows are eligible that certain categories like best score may not even be awarded. Meanwhile, NBC is planning a TV celebration of Broadway, though producers are trying to figure out if it's worth casting or reassembling.
All the producers of these Broadway shows are saying, yeah, should we spend the money to put on a performance on TV when no one can actually run out and buy a ticket to the show anyway?
Yeah, like, is that, maybe, I don't know. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, the NBC special is bizarre. If you can do that, why the heck aren't you doing the Tony Awards? Everybody had all sorts of ideas, celebrate Broadway in general. They've decided to just say the shows that opened up by a certain date in February would be eligible rather than June. And that pushes some shows to next year because next year's going to be sparse as well. They're only going to have maybe a spring, if at all. But the bad thing is shows like West Side, you could win a Tony when nobody can see your show and you might never reopen it. It's all just a nightmare. But if the Tony Awards are going online, how is NBC doing a show celebrating Broadway? And who's going to pay for it? Because the producers are like, well, that's kind of complicated. Our cast is scattered to the winds. and we'd have to get them back together, deal with all these pandemic restrictions, rehearse it, and do a performance. And then people will watch it and say, oh, I'd love to buy a ticket if only the show was in production.
And Cameron McIntosh said, okay, let me call my never mind.
Yeah, bad news in the UK. That Cameron McIntosh, two different companies, I think there are two of them, they are firing a total of more than 850 people. That is a lot of people for and the theater industry in London.
What are they known for?
Cameron McIntosh, oh, he's one of the biggest, the mega musicals of the 80s. You know, he's just one of the biggest producers of all time.
Yes, I think Les Mis is one of...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's why I was...
But a lot of shows.
That was a softball. I was throwing you a softball let it go right by.
Well, here's a softball for you. Music festivals.
Okay. Well, the Oregon Music Festival. Get this. I love this name. It's Sold Out. That's the name of the festival.
A lot of soul there. You got, you'll have a lot of soul by the end of the weekend.
Yeah, S-O-U-L. Well, it is taking Coachella back to court after a new reversal. Its lawsuit against the concert behemoth, or the festival behemoth, is moving forward. The promoters behind Sold Out. I'm going to say that every single time
please don't.
Okay. Well, they are suing Coachella over what's known as a radius clause. That's the part of an agreement where an artist, a musician, agrees to perform at a festival like Coachella and agrees not to perform within a certain geographic radius of said festival for a certain period of time, both before and after the event takes place. Now, naturally, you don't want to pay an act millions of dollars to appear at your festival and then draw fans only to see them, you know, play another concert down the street 1 week earlier or 2 weeks later. But many promoters say the radius clause is an unconstitutional block to free enterprise and competition. And they're going to get their day in court. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, like almost anything, a radius clause is a little reasonable, but then it's been pushed to extremes and abused. You know, like you can't do anything for a month before or after. Or an artist who wants to do a set at Coachella and then go to a club and do an after party. No, you can't do, you know, they just got out of control. And I think it really does need to be reined in. But what do you think?
I think this is a big deal if it actually gets to court, because I think this kind of stuff needs to be aired out and it needs to be settled once and for all. The Coachella radius clause is upwards of 6 months for some bands.
Oh, that's awful. That's ridiculous.
And so they can't perform anywhere on the West Coast. Look, Oregon. Okay. And this was a very small band. Okay. That they wanted to book.
They had an afternoon gig for 20 minutes on one side fest, and like, you know, you can't perform anywhere. Yeah, no, that's just crazy.
And so, you know, 6 months is ridiculous.
That's 3 months before and 3 months after, I assume?
I think it's mostly before.
I mean, if it was 6 months before and after, it would be never. You could never perform anywhere else.
No.
Because that's the year. 6 months before, that would be the year.
I think it's like 4 months after. I think because it's close to the beginning of the summer, they basically say, sure, do Coachella because people want to see you first with us, and then you can play LA like, you know, in August or July.
But it's been abused and they need to stop.
But here's how they're really abusing it. So Coachella is owned by Golden Voice, which is owned by AEG. They're basically saying, hey, look, you want to perform at the Nokia Theater, which we book and own? Sure. You want to perform at, or I think it's the Microsoft Theater now. You want to perform at the Fonda Theater, which we own and book? Sure. But if you want to go anywhere else, no, I'm sorry.
Then we're going to hold you to your radius clause. Yeah, that's just another way they're abusing the system. But hey, Sperling, you saw David Byrne at Coachella, and it was just an amazing show. Then he went to Broadway. You've got tickets to see him on Broadway, don't you?
I do. And actually, I haven't checked to find out what is happening with that show.
Well, they hope to bring it. They'll bring it back someday, I assume. But you won't have to wait because you can see it on HBO. That live performance that they recorded, Spike Lee recorded it, filmed it. They are debuting on HBO October 17th. So we now have a date for that performance of that. You'll still want to see it live because I'm sure it's just a great, great show.
You know what? It makes me so angry. I'm ready to burn down the house.
All right, keep going. When you win, keep going, you know.
Okay. Well, okay, look, this next story, that was fast, okay? Because Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York gained a lot of notice for his succinct and helpful press conferences during the early stages of the pandemic. I mean, we all tuned in to find out what was going on with his daughter's boyfriend. Remember that?
No, I don't.
Now Cuomo is putting out a book about the trials he faced and calls it American Crisis, Leadership from the COVID-19 Pandemic. It comes out in October, even though a number of people blasted the governor, wondering, well, first, how did you have the time to write a book so fast? And aren't we all still dealing with this thing called the coronavirus? And isn't it a little early for, like, I don't know, a victory lap since, you know, movie theaters are still closed? The governor brushed off critics and said he was going to the gym. No, he brushed off critics saying the book isn't about beating the pandemic, but about what we can learn from the early days of the pandemic. So is this a big deal or a big whoop? And I would actually wait around for the answer to that, but I'm going to go write a book about, people writing books about the COVID-19 pandemic.
I think it's a big whoop in the grand scheme of things, but just adds to the sense that Cuomo is a bit tone deaf when it comes to politics, which sounds like a weird thing to say, but this guy yearns to run for president and doing stuff like this doesn't help. It's moronic. I heard about it and thought, this is moronic for every reason that everyone is given. And just for the optics of it, doesn't care matter how good the book is and how you're just showing, you know, we're fighting a pandemic. So let's learn. It's like, no, you should not be releasing a book and promoting it and talking about it. That's absurd. We're not even remotely done with this yet. Too soon.
Well, okay, so then let's move on to maybe something that, it's probably not too soon for, because remember when we had the Cable Ace Awards?
I do.
You know, back when cable shows, they weren't really eligible for Emmys, so they created their own awards show in 1978. Now, in 1988, the Emmys started recognizing cable shows, but, you know, they were kind of like none too eager about, like, saying, oh, okay, fine, this HBO, they'd give them like one nomination. So the Cable Ace Awards, they hung around until 1997. By then, cable shows were competitive in top categories. So job done. Well, now it's the major networks that are being shut out at the Emmys. Sure, they're eligible for the awards. They're just not winning any of them. They're barely even getting nominated, okay? So in a column in Variety, Michael Schneider, their TV columnist, he asks, should the major networks create their own awards again? Or should they just, you know, I don't know, make better shows? Big deal or big whoop?
I mean, this is the saddest question I've heard in a long time, but it's true. You know, they're literally not even competitive. Maybe they're lucky to get one sitcom nomination or one drama nomination year in and year out. And that's not going to change based on any new shows that we've seen or any new shows that are on the horizon. So it would be pathetic to launch your own award show because you're not good enough to win the one you want. That's not the same as the Cable Ace Awards, where they just weren't even allowed, and then they became so good at it that they started winning every category they were eligible in. So this is very, very sad, but it's he's not even really joking, but it just shows you how the quality level of network television has dropped just as it's exploded on cable and online.
Speaking of awards, the Berlin Film Festival made some announcements. Big deal or big, no, just kidding. They're going to hold a physical in-person film festival. At least that's what they think. Berlin will also host a hybrid film market, both in person and online. And its awards are going gender neutral. So that means no best actress, no best actor, just best actor, best performance.
Right. In a lead role. Yeah.
Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. But it's another nail in the coffin of having one category of awards be gender specific when none of the others are. It's not best female director. It's not best female writer. It's not best female editor. It's just best editor. There's no reason anymore for this to continue. It works at the Grammys. It will work for the Emmys and the Oscars. The sooner they do it, the better.
Now, here's... I'm going to play devil's advocate.
Well, you've said everybody, you're going to ignore women. Well, you know what? Where they've done it Grammys and Emmys and other stuff other eras where they go gender neutral, like golden, you know, there are categories and awards. It's been okay. In fact, sometimes women dominate. You know, it just depends on the year and the shows and the way to bring attention to, people of color and women and non-binary people is not to create little categories. One of the worst things in the Oscars is that no animated film has ever won Best Picture. Why? Because they have their own secondary category. They should have won long ago, and they almost never will, nor will a documentary, because they have their own little category, which isn't as important and isn't as prestigious, and it keeps them out of the top award, and it's a shame.
What I would say is, and again, playing devil's advocate, is that one of the thing about these particular awards, maybe not at film festivals, but at the Oscars, well, yeah, you know what? And at film festivals, is that you know, getting these awards, it helps promote the movie, right? And I get that you don't want to, you know,
there are other ways you can come up with new smart categories to honor other areas of the film. You don't have to just break people apart by gender to do that. You need an extra award to promote the film. There's plenty of things to think about. Best cast, best special effects, best stunts, whatever. What I mean, that's not going to work at Berlin, but best casting might well work. And that's a valid award. That's different from Best Picture. Your Best Picture might have two people in it, and another movie might be bursting with young talent like The Breakfast Club. And you say, wow, what a great new cast. So you want to create new categories? Best casting. There you go. That's long deserved at the Oscars. And that can bring attention to new small films with great new talent. Yeah, it'll probably end up going to a big studio with the most names in it. But, you know, that's the idea. The idea that you have to keep these outdated categories because you're worried a film might possibly lose attention or a certain gender might not get as much attention this year as they would have otherwise. It's like, no.
Yeah, you know, I guess I look at it and go, you had four awards. Now you're down to two.
No, you're not. You don't have to be down to two. You can come up with other awards. It's okay.
Well, then I would have done that at the same time.
Well, you can. But a film festival isn't really the place where you're going to toss in new awards to help a film promote. Basically, at a film festival, if you win the top prize, it helps. Otherwise, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, well, you know, I wonder if it'll matter how many screens Tenet plays on.
Well, of course it will.
No, yeah, you think it will? Because that is really our story for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, I will tell you off the top here, we're talking about Tenet. We're going to be talking about some very inside baseball stuff, but here's how it affects you. You will, in the long run, probably pay more for movie tickets if this continues. So let's just start there.
Well, you may pay less if they get rid of the 3D bunk, so you won't have that premium. Yes. And movie tickets for decades have stayed basically in pace with inflation. In fact, it's a little less than they were in the 70s. So I wouldn't be too worried about that. Tickets are certainly very expensive in big cities, but when you look historically, it's not so bad. But yeah, so we were wondering, what is Warner Brothers going to demand? And the one big takeaway we have is that they're now saying they want 63% of the gross.
Well, wow. Okay, so here's that,
that's not unprecedented, right?
It is not unprecedented. You have Star Wars that was getting roughly about that.
What's the biggest percentage any movie ever got that we know
65.
About?
65. I mm-hmm. think that was like, you know, like a big Avengers kind of movie. Mm-hmm. Star Wars Avengers kind of thing. And it was based on scale, meaning that you had that film had to reach a certain level of the domestic market for that to hit. Okay. Right. So this is only North America. Okay. Right. So let's state that. Right. We're going to get to international in just a moment. So just before we get to international.
Before you get off on a... So they said 63%, which didn't completely freak people out because that's not unprecedented for a big, big movie like this. They, of course, said, your theater must uphold the most stringent mask wearing safety standards that we can point to, which is also reasonable. They don't want to be in a theater.
You have to comply with local health.
Of course
you do. There's a reason for that. They didn't basically want theaters to open and say, well, I'm going to open despite what the government says, and so send me.
They can't do that. Nothing to do with the studio. They can't do that. That would be against the rules, and the local city or state would shut them down. If that's their concern, that's silly, and it wouldn't reflect on Warner Brothers. But yes, they, as we've already said, they must follow the strictest standards, even more than their local city and state. But of course they must follow their local standards. They must. Of course they will. Nor can they say, we will only follow the local standards. They want it to go beyond that. They're saying, even if your local community says you don't have to wear a mask, we're saying you must, because those are the standards of NATO. So, yes. They wanted a percentage that was reasonable for a big blockbuster. They clearly, of course, want you to follow the most stringent safety mask standards because they want movie going to be considered safe. They don't want Tenet to be the source of a big outbreak of coronavirus in a town, right? So they want to take all the precautions they can. But, you know, they want the biggest screen. That often happens every week, doesn't it? The big new movies.
For 12 weeks.
Yeah, now that's where we're getting crazy. Now we're talking.
Okay, and... they want their money now.
Now, why? Yeah, this really stood out to me. They're if you've got a multiplex, like a 9 screens or more, they want you to guarantee their movie will play for 3 months, for 12 weeks. If you're
on the biggest screen.
Oh, well, they normally back off that after week 7 if it's really fallen, though, don't they? Like they often demand that and then they cave. Like, yeah, it's okay.
Well, basically, when you look at 12 weeks, you basically, so you want it to play there until Wonder Woman comes out?
No, but Wonder Woman comes out in 2 weeks. 2 weeks after Tenet. So yeah, that's my
month. I thought it was October 3rd.
Oh, all right. Well, everything's changed all the time, but it's well within the time frame of what they're talking about. Even if you only have 3 to 8 screens, they say you got to keep our movie on the biggest screen for 8 weeks. Even if you just have 2 screens, they want it for more than 5 weeks, which again means bumping into Wonder Woman. How can we have 2 big movies playing at the same time in North America? I don't think there's the room. Even if they were playing fair, even if they split all the screens in half, that's just with 50% capacity or 30% capacity. It's just not enough, is it?
No, it probably isn't. They're probably going to need a 3-week run clean on like a majority of the screens.
So Wonder Woman is screwed.
Wonder Woman might get pushed back one more time if Tenet is doing well. Tenet is basically the canary in the coal mine. You know, they're sending it in. And here's the thing. I talked to a number of exhibitors, both here in North America and abroad. Here's what's going on. So we got over at CJ, here's how the sausage is made, by the way. Mm-hmm. We got a number of emails from circuits, from cinema chains, saying, we're not going to play Tenet because of the terms they're asking for. Internationally, Warner Brothers is asking for 55%, okay?
But that's a big increase on what they normally get, isn't it?
From they've been 40 to 45%? Yes,
so
it's a huge increase.
Is that the biggest increase ever for is that the biggest percentage they've ever been able to demand in, say, Europe?
Yes.
No one's ever done.
Disney 5 to 7% increase.
Disney did not. Well, don't say percent because that's inaccurate, but like they went up 5 percentage points. So like Disney has never asked for more than 50% of gross in the EU.
I think they may have tried for.
Well,
Avengers.
I mean, they never got it. Yeah, they never got it.
Yeah. I don't know whether they got it or not. They may have.
So they're pushing the limits overseas, not as much here in North America, but they are pushing the limits overseas in some territory.
They're pushing the limits here too. And here's why. 63% is about a percentage point or two beyond what would be normal. But that's fine. That's fine. Like you said,
for blockbuster films, it was 65%.
Okay. So they went up a percentage point. You know what? You'll go up a percentage point on Warner Brothers and in the background on some other film that you've got next year, we're going to talk you down by a percentage point. Okay. So we're going to try and make up for that percentage point that you took away. However, you're doing it at a time where you know we're hurting, and we know you're hurting too, Warner Brothers, but you kind of know we're hurting as movie theaters. But we also get the following. Here's what a lot of exhibitors that are kind of COO level, CEO level. They all said, listen, if you have poor credit rating, okay, and we're giving you a loan as a bank, we're going to charge you more because we're going to price risk into the cost of doing business. Uh-huh. This is Warner Brothers pricing risk into the cost. You want the movie? You don't want us to go straight to PVOD? Then guess what? We're going to ask for more upfront. And in fact, because we don't know that you're going to in 21 days, which is the average, what we usually ask you for money as a studio, 21 days after the play week, we're going to be asking for it week to week within.
Because they're worried you will be out of business.
Correct. And, or that you'll keep the money for who knows, months and months and months. And if you don't pay us, we are not giving.
Of course. If you don't pay, we're going to pull the movie. Of course.
Well, they don't even have to pull the movie.
Right.
It's pre-pulled.
I know. Yes. But technologically, it's very simple. You don't have to ship back a reel. They can just say, no, you don't have access to it.
Right. Because they ship a decryption key.
Right.
But they won't ship it to you.
Right. So, of course. Yeah. But is it possible for theaters to send money every week? They're not really normally equipped to it. Can they just speed up that process? And if so, they're never going to go back. They're going to say, why are we waiting 3 weeks? I mean, if you can send it to us every week.
What I would say to Warner Brothers.
And again, my feeling is there's no reason they should be able to send that money for 3 weeks because they're just making the interest on it. I don't like it when I deposit a check and a bank says, oh, it's taken us 5 business. It's like BS.
A couple points there. Mm-hmm. I asked about that. I said, well, you know, what about the interest? And the guy was, and everybody I spoke with, all the guys and gals I spoke with went, yeah, let's talk about interest. What is it, like 0.5% now? Is it 1%?
It adds up.
And they said, yeah, it doesn't add up that much, number one. Number two, basically what they're doing there is they're doing their audits and they're making sure that what they pay is accurate. And they're also holding on to it in case the movie is a complete, if it tanks and they're supposed to be paying scale, which means they're supposed to be paying 63% If the film makes $300 million in the US, and they pay that the first, second, third week of playdates, if the seventh, eighth, ninth playdate weeks aren't, you know, if it's like, no, it's going to top out at $200 million, then they can pull back from there, as opposed to
asking for the money back.
Yes, exactly. That's one of the reasons they do that. And also, one of the struggles that these exhibitors are going to have is right now, managing payroll is one of their biggest concerns. They are not staffed up, not only in the theaters, but also at the head office. So they're like, you know,
they don't have they don't have the people power to deal with all this.
Correct.
Well, that's an interesting point. So are you telling me that just like an actor will get an extra, say, $10 million if their movie hits the $500 million mark worldwide, they have these sort of escalation clauses. You're telling me movie theaters have an escalation clause? The chains have a clause where if, in fact, Tenet does not pass the $300 million mark in North America, they automatically only have to pay 60% of the gross rather than 63%? Is that written into their contracts?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I've never heard that. That's interesting.
Yeah, and it's sometimes in the master license agreement where they say, here's our master license agreement, unless otherwise noted, and then they can negotiate per film. So let's say they say, look, we're going to charge you, if the film hits $300 million, and by the way, it is $300 million since every single exhibitor I talk to used $300 million as the domestic
gross. As an example.
Yeah, as an example.
They didn't reveal any information, but they said, if, for example... Yeah, the movie was right. Okay.
Let's not get anyone into trouble. Since you're all saying that, I'm going to go with it's probably $300 million. But that said, they'll pay 60%. And then if it hits $300 million, then they'll have to pay more in later weeks. It might be 65% to make up for the they'll have to kind of settle, what they call settle. And that's one of the reasons they hold on to money as well.
Right, but so we don't know what they got in China, for example.
Well, we do. It's 25%. I mean, that's pretty much what it's...
They weren't able to move the... Well, they weren't able to say, hey, you really want a big movie, and we're here.
No. Welcome to China.
All right. So you don't think that happened? All right.
No, not at all.
And so if they push this on the money, they're never going to want to go back to waiting 3 weeks, ever.
They might go back to their master license agreement, because those master license agreements are actually signed for years, like for a number of years. So the exhibitor could kind of go back and say, listen, you know what? You want your money in a week? Fine. We're doing 57%. There's ways to negotiate around that. For instance, no exhibitor thought that this 12-week thing was going to stand. They were all like, there's no way that's standing. You have Wonder Woman coming out. You're telling me you still want Tenet on the big screen. Now, I can say that I heard from a number of sources that apparently AT&T wanted Tenet pushed back to after January 1st. They said, fine, we'll just release it in movie theaters, but you gotta wait. In fact, we're willing to pay Christopher Nolan some money, a little bonus bump.
There's $10 million to wait.
Well, not millions. We're willing to pay him to get him to wait. And apparently the response from Christopher Nolan was no effing way. And Warner Brothers went for it. But those are the terms.
I find it hard to believe they would set a term of $300 million for domestic box office, because except for two Batman films, none of his films have ever crossed $300 million. Not Interstellar and not Interception, to be specific. Those are the big movies. That made $292 million. Interstellar,
which is why everybody was like, look,
and Interstellar made $188 million. So this is an original film without a pre-sold thing. That's not a metric they're likely to hit, especially in this environment.
Right. And that's why all the exhibitors were saying, look, okay, fine. They're pricing it like it made $300 million and we know
we'll get the money back.
They're pricing we might not get the money back on this film. We'll get it back on some other.
And the most important thing about this, I think, is not the percentage, not the payment problem, which is internal, and I can appreciate their issues, but it's the screen count and the amount of screens that they want to hold on to for the amount of time. If at this rate, say they're going to need a month to play out, 3 weeks to 4 weeks, that means there can be one big movie a month. You know, it'll play longer than that. It will play longer than that. But yeah, New Mutants, nothing. But you're saying, all right, in August, is it August or September that this comes out? Is it August?
Then it's September, yeah, it's here in the U.S. Right, but so you know what? It's not coming out in August. It's not coming out in any date in New York and L.A.
Right. So it's Tenet for September, Wonder Woman for October, another movie for November. So that's four movies. That's what you can realistically accommodate, because it will continue playing beyond those 4 weeks. But another big movie has stepped in and they need the screens or they're not going to be able to make any real money. So that's what we're looking at. One big movie a month for the rest of the year. Four movies. Making serious coin. That's what they've done in China. They had one big movie and it made money. And you can do that here, but there aren't going to be two. There's not going to be three. There's not going to be a movie every 2 weeks, especially with terms like that.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, you really want to get into the weeds here. Think about it this way. Let's say you're, I don't know, Warner Brothers Film X. Let's call it Film X. Okay. And you come out in July of 2021 and people are going back to the movies again and it's a highly anticipated film and it's going to make some money. And you know what? You're the director on that or the producer on that. And you have, you know, you're going to get bonuses based on net profits. Okay. Movie theaters are going to try and make back what they lost on Tenet on your film. And so when Warner Brothers comes and says, oh, we didn't make a profit on that, it's because, you know, the movie theaters are taking out, you know, on some completely unrelated movie. And that's just what happens. It happens all the time.
Yep. Well, it's not the death of the movie business, but they're still making it hard to bring it back to life, aren't they?
They are, absolutely. And speaking of death, mm-hmm. let's talk about Justin Townes Earl, the son of Steve Earle. He died at the age of 38. He's a musician. And I guess they're not saying what
I don't think we know yet, but he definitely followed in his dad's footsteps. Steve Earle's one of my favorite artists around. And Justin became both a singer and a songwriter steeped in Americana. And he also battled addictions to drugs and alcohol. So that's what we fear may have been at play here, though he had been sober. And no matter what the reason, it's just sad. It's a sickness and an addiction and an illness, just like if he died from cancer or anything else. So there's no more or less shame or sadness around his death. You know, so it's just an awful thing. You know, it's sad to see, of course, to have anybody die. And a lot of people have done it. But, you know, when you die young and a parent has to bury a child, that's about the worst thing imaginable. But there was one amusing element here. His name is Justin Townes Earl. He's named after Townes Van Zandt, a great Texas singer-songwriter. And Justin said his mom hated Townes Van Zandt. Like, as a person, did not like Townes Van Zandt. And he said he hated the name. And his dad said, I want to name him Townes. And she said, no. And so they compromised and he only got Townes as a middle name. And he said, and she would still play his music, but she did not like him.
Well, also dying was at the age of 73 was an executive who most people may not know. His name is Colin Leventhal. He was over at Channel 4 and then what became Film 4. And if that sounds familiar, it's because they're responsible for Four Weddings and a Funeral, Madness of King George, lots of Mike Leigh films like Secrets and Lies, Shallow Grave for director Danny Boyle. He also, I think, did Trainspotting.
Yeah, for Channel 4. Yeah, absolutely.
For Channel 4. So all these films that are really great films, he was one of the executives working on them.
Yeah, he was a key player and beloved in the industry, really well-respected guy. And there were many, I mean, Channel 4 still does good stuff in Film 4, but there were many, many years in the 80s and 90s when you would just see Film 4 and sit back and think, you know, it was like Orion in its heyday. You thought, there's a really good chance I'm about to see a good movie. So that's a pretty amazing, you know, track record to have. And speaking of the track, actor Ben Cross from Chariots of Fire has died at 72. He was a working class lad who got into RADA. He was just working all sorts of jobs. I think his dad died young and he took all these sorts of odd jobs, including like working backstage at a theater. And he's standing in the wings going, I can do that. And he applied to RADA and got in. And then stage and screen success followed. He did an acclaimed turn in a stage production of Chicago in London. That's what helped him. Got a little notice and he got to go to the casting call for Chariots of Fire. That, of course, was a huge film. Then he played Sarek. Young people might know him as Sarek, the father of Spock in the 2009 reboot of Star Trek. You know, Chariots of Fire was the peak of his career in many ways, though Sarek is a nice credit. He worked steadily in TV and film right up until the end, but he'll be remembered forever as the Jewish athlete who faced unending prejudice from his own teammates and countrymen while striving to compete in the Olympics in Paris in 1924. Based on a true story, it was a worldwide hit. It became the little film that could when it won the Best Picture at the Oscars. At the BAFTAs, it lost almost all the major awards except one for Ian Holm and Best Picture. And at the Oscars, it lost almost all the major awards except for Screenplay and Score and Best Picture. So, you know, that's that year he was competing against Atlantic City, On Golden Pond, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Reds, Gregory's Girl, The French Lieutenant's Women, but Chariots of Fire triumphed over them all. And if I just happened to watch it recently on TV, I think it really holds up well. It's a just a heartwarming, happy film.
Well, let's not disparage The French Lieutenant, because it was The French Lieutenant's Woman, not Women. So he really was, it was just the one woman.
Yeah, the French, did I say women? Oh, I beg your pardon. Well, yes, no, Meryl Streep had them all to herself.
Yes, and you have us all to yourselves each week. In fact, if you subscribe to our show in iTunes, Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you know, you won't miss an episode. And in fact, please do rate and review the podcast.
And you haven't. You're home. You're working from home. You have time.
Yeah, you know, come on. What else are you doing besides watching Netflix and Hulu and Disney Plus?
Keep going.
Okay, well, you know what? You can find that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or like us on Facebook, where our page can be found at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. You know, the music at the beginning and end of our show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have their own website. It is whoismgmt.com. But Michael Gilch has his own website, and every week it's something new and exciting. I have a feeling it's going to have something to do with Chariots of Fire. What is it this week,
Mike? Right. It's vangelis.com.
Oh, okay. So look that up.
I can't seem to get through. I'm not sure if it's I typed in Vangelis and it's not even saying available or not available, or it's a website or whatever. It should be a website, obviously, for the talented composer, but nothing's coming up. I don't know what's going on there.
Well, when you actually Google that, listeners, I will tell you that when you hear the song that's from Chariots of Fire, you will hate us because it will stick in your head.
It's one of the craziest scores of all time. You're doing a period film like that. The idea of doing an electronic score is completely wacky, but it worked great.
It did. And you know what? If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that website, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com? Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.